Mark Crispin Whitler, thanks so much for coming on Politics and Science. I really appreciate it. And I haven't talked to you in a number of years, but you were up here in the Mad River Valley, I think maybe was it 10 years ago, Mark? You spoke at the Green Mountain Global Forum about election reform and election integrity.
Yeah, it feels like a century ago, doesn't it?
It does feel like a long time ago, I'm afraid to say. And, Mark, let me just give you your bio that you have on your webpage. Mark Crispin Miller is a professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University. You've written many books, including The Culture of TV, Boxed In, The Bush Dyslexicon, Cruel and Unusual, Bush Cheney's New World Order, Fooled Again, The Real Case for Election Reform, Seeing Through the Movies, which I'm not familiar with, and Loser Take All, Election Fraud and the Subversion of Democracy. And you're currently working on something new. What's that about? The Marlboro Man, an American Success Story.
Yeah, well, yes, I've been working on that for quite a long time. It's about half finished. My progress on it was interrupted by a struggle with Lyme disease. Speaking of science and medicine. I expect to have that done in a year or two, depending on what happens with the current crisis, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting, too, because, well, maybe we'll talk about that a little later, but there was some indication that the Lyme disease may have originated from a U.S. Weapons biolab.
That's actually beyond dispute.
Is it?
There are a couple of, yeah. Well, there around the turn of this century, there was a book called Lab 257 about Plum Island, and the author, whose name has escaped me at the moment, makes the case in his first chapter that the Nazis were the first to weaponize ticks, and that some of the scientists who worked on that endeavor under Hitler were then naturally imported over here to continue with that work. And there's a more recent book by Chris Newby called Bitten, which came out last year and offers more detail specifically on the Swiss scientist who worked on the American program to weaponize ticks with what we now call Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that book, I did a podcast with Chris on Peter B. Collins' show. And the odd thing about that book is that it actually moved Congress to demand some truth about this from the Department of Defense. Even though the book had that effect on Congress, it received no reviews in the American media. It's kind of a strange thing. I guess it was circulated among congressmen, but it's not as well known as it should be, because Lyme disease is a genuine epidemic. It's been spreading inexorably since it first popped up in the late 60s, but it's been overshadowed by COVID along with everything else.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like it was in the news last fall. A congressperson was calling for some clarity on the issue. And do you remember who that was? And then I didn't hear anything about it after that.
Yeah, that's right. I've been meaning to look into whether or not they got any kind of reply. I'm sure whatever reply they got was vague and unilluminating, but that's just one example of the many ways in which our government's covert investment in toxic research of all kinds has had a really catastrophic effect on our health. I mean, Lyme disease is just one example. But I guess it's appropriate that we start our conversation with this subject, because it does pertain to the lethality of so much war-related research and experiments.
Yeah, and I believe we signed some bioweapons agreements where we're not supposed to be developing weapons of that sort internationally, and yet we continue to do so with black budgets, it appears.
Yeah, it's just one of so many aspects of this crisis that the press has ignored or lied about. I find it increasingly difficult to even to pick up, much less read through each day's New York Times, which I still get. I mean, I'm professionally obligated to leaf through it day after day. But they just today's paper, passingly refers, as if it were gospel truth, to this virus's emergence from that wet market in Wuhan, China. What it was Luc Montagnier, the French Nobelist, who I guess discovered the HIV virus, has looked into the RNA of this coronavirus and found little bits of HIV embedded in it, which he claims could never in a million years have happened naturally. And something else, that was on French TV last month, and I sent that around to my listserv, but I just came across something else today, which reconfirms the, let's say, the unlikeliness of that natural emergence scenario, which comes straight out of the end of the movie Contagion. I don't know if you saw that,
No,
but
I didn't.
yeah, the last, I don't mean to, spoiler alert, the last scene shows, I think it's a monkey or some tree-born creature dropping a banana onto the ground, and I think a pig eating it. And this is supposed to reveal how Gwyneth Paltrow, who's patient zero in the movie, caught the disease eating in a restaurant, and then she has an affair with some guy. And so she's punished for this infidelity with death, and goes from there. And the
Oh, God.
CDC is heroic bureaucracy in the movie. One of its scientists selflessly comes up with a vaccine that she uses on herself to see if it works. And the villain of the piece is a detestable conspiracy theorist played by Jude Law, who knowingly fakes a natural cure and markets it online. I mean, he pretends to be sick with this virus, dramatically takes some of his own concoction, and right before our eyes feels better, and then he makes a lot of money selling this. Well, at the end, he gets his because the feds come and drag him away for fraud. It's such a vile film, and it does, eerily foretell this crisis. It would be an example of what some people call predictive programming. I'm on the fence about whether that's as extensive as we're told, but it certainly is striking. And the natural origin story is increasingly wobbly, since all these microbiologists have so much time on their hands, they're all stuck at home. They've been kind of crowdsourcing research into this virus and its origins, and this is something you would never know from reading or watching the mainstream or even the left liberal media. But it's that theory is very weak, and it this thing clearly was devised as a bioweapon,
The only thing that makes me doubt the bioweapon origin of the COVID is the fact that it actually doesn't seem to be weaponized.
Well, that's a very complicated issue.
I mean, if you listen to certain epidemiologists that the media doesn't seem to talk to, even though they're in good standing at all their universities, that's what they're saying.
Well, what they're saying, And I think we're talking about the same people, people like John Ioannidis and
yeah.
Newt Witkowski. You know, I'm very close friends with the people making that terrific documentary series of interviews, perspectives on the pandemic, which your listeners should definitely check out. You have to do it on BitChute, though, because YouTube has been taking down these interviews. But these are very eminent epidemiologists, and they're not exactly saying that it's the same as the flu.
No.
They're saying that the death rate is comparable to the death rate from flu. And there are aspects of the disease at its most advanced that are quite unusual. This young guy, Dr. Cameron Kyle Seidel, who works at the Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, made a video, this must be 2 months ago, in his kitchen telling us about the strangeness of this disease, which he thought, and in this he was kind of prophetic, he thought was much more like high altitude sickness than a typical respiratory distress syndrome, because the patients seem to suffer from hypoxia, you know, which is insufficient oxygen in the red blood cells. Their lungs weren't really at issue, and his bold and really important observation was that ventilators were probably the worst way to treat this disease. And you know, this is a propaganda meme. We've heard endlessly about the need for ventilators.
Yeah.
We don't have enough ventilators. We got to get people on ventilators. Well, he argued that putting people with this condition on ventilators is practically a surefire way to kill them, because it stresses the lungs, scars them, and blows them out. And I can kind of confirm his theory. I mean, I'm not a physician, but I have a very close friend, a colleague here at NYU, who caught the disease. He and his wife got it. She was asymptomatic, but he got gravely ill. And he spent a week at Mount Sinai, where his doctor said to him, he was at stage 3 of this disease, and he's 85, so it didn't look good. His doctor said, you have two choices. You can either go on a ventilator, in which case you will die, or you can choose not to go on a ventilator, in which case you'll have a 5% chance of pulling through.
Wow.
So he took the second option, and he miraculously pulled through. I mean, he's quite weak now.
Yeah.
So it is a real thing. Whether it's even a virus, we don't actually know. You know, because the virus has not been purified. Some people theorize that it could be exosomes, you know, which cells secrete under certain kinds of stress.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know, and I'm not a virologist, though. You know, I'm a student of propaganda,
yeah.
So I try to make it my business to follow, you know, all those people who are trying to speak honestly about this condition. And I guess I should plug my listserv to your listeners. It's News from Underground, and I send out every day, you know, information like the information we're discussing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Dr. Kyle Seidel was disciplined by his hospital, demoted for questioning their protocol.
I saw that video, and I was impressed by his observations, but I didn't know he was punished.
He was punished, but a few weeks later, there emerged a growing global medical consensus that he was right, that ventilators are not the way to go. That it's another propaganda meme. Hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin and zinc, you know, that regimen really does appear to work. Hundreds of doctors, possibly thousands, have been using it. I sent out a news report from a Houston TV station. were using hydroxychloroquine and what they called a cocktail of steroids, vitamins, and blood thinners. Hmm. There are various ways to treat this disease without our having to wait for that magical vaccine. But this is all about, I mean, this whole crisis, it seems to me, is all about, among other things, pushing us toward universal mandatory vaccination. Because that's the case, the press completely blacks out the news of a really remarkable range of medicinal treatments, herbal treatments, many of which have been scientifically tested, especially in China.
Yeah.
There are many ways to deal with this disease. Ventilators are a way to kill people, it seems. And the way that Dr. Fauci and now the World Health Organization has suspended its testing of hydroxychloroquine out of safety concerns. I mean, you know, we're really through the looking glass when we hear news like this, because that drug has been used for 70 years to treat malaria and lupus and other conditions.
Mm-hmm.
It has shown remarkable effectiveness against COVID-19. But there's this big push to play that down, to call that anecdotal, to, you know, hype the risks of the side effects. It has some side effects in people with cardiological problems.
Yeah.
But it's successful. It works. And yet we're being told all the time that it doesn't, and we're told this because Trump touts it, you know, and to those who have swallowed the blue pill, you know, anything that Trump says is by definition wrong. You know?
Yeah. It's a strange false dichotomy. It seems like you can't talk about the science issue, because if you disagree with what, you know, the mainstream press seems to say over and over again, then you must be for Trump.
You must be for Trump, exactly.
Yeah.
It's very odd. It's really unbelievable. I mean, I sent this out, this little epigram I wrote the other day was, Ditto Heads come in two flavors, red and blue. The red ones yell, whatever Trump says, I believe it.
Mm-hmm.
The blue ones yell, whatever Trump says, I believe the opposite. Thus, Trump controls the thinking on both sides. You know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Both sides are equally brainless, you know, and it's really kind of eerie how many people fall into one category or the other.
Yeah, I'm a little confused by it. It's almost like we're watching a play about the news, you know, a theater play about the news, and we forget that we seem to be getting distracted by the actual players and not the quality of the news that's coming through.
Oh, absolutely! It is like theater. I compare it to pro wrestling. You know,
that's really good. Yeah, that's really true, because Trump is a pro wrestler in a way.
He is, but he is a pro wrestler. He's exactly like the guy, the bad guy in a wrestling match, you know, and people love to boo him.
Mm-hmm.
It's really pure theater. The whole thing is pure theater, and both sides are invested in the show. You know, nobody wants to talk about the facts. You know, it's amazing. If you talk about the facts, you're a conspiracy theorist. You know, and you end up getting blocked on Twitter. Your YouTube takes down your videos. It's just amazing.
Well, they say in the news, they always tell you to leave the the facts to the experts. You know, don't actually do any thinking for yourself.
And that is
generally the tone I've noticed in the New York Times. I get the New York Times briefing every morning, which is like a very shortened version for and sales pitch for their newspaper. And the tone is very pedantic. It's very, you know, they're instructing you basically not what happened, but so much how to think about what happened.
That's exactly right. You know, they're always telling us what's a hoax, what's fake news, what's misinformation, and what isn't. You And this is the newspaper that yesterday, you must have seen this, you know, devoted its entire front page to several columns of tiny print listing 1,000 of the what they claim to be 100,000 people who have died of COVID-19. That was the front page, you know, a headline all the way across the top about this milestone, that the nation has reached this milestone.
Yeah.
And then front page and several inside pages are filled with tiny print mini obituaries of these people all across the country with a poignant little sentence about each one, you know. How did they come up with these names? Well, they say that they scoured death notices and obituaries in the press nationwide. That's their idea of reporting. I mean, first of all, we know for a fact that the CDC has explicitly instructed doctors to write down COVID-19, to come to that diagnosis, even if it's only presumed to be COVID-19. Okay, so there's not even any necessity to test for it. If it sort of looks like that, you say that that's what it is, you know, and hospitals are incentivized to do this because they get a certain amount of money for each COVID patient they take and for each ventilator that they use. Okay, so they're actually profiting from this
it's a
misrepresentation.
And it's a significant amount of money also. It's not, you know, small change.
That's right. It's what, something of $30,000+.
Yeah. At the same time, they're being starved of funds from their regular business. So it's
almost like they have no choice.
The hospital.
Well, yes. Yeah. Okay. So on top of the CDC's explicit order to count practically anything as COVID-19, you know, it could be flu, it could be pneumonia. There's also the fact that the available COVID-19 test kits are, you know, wildly unreliable. There's a false positive rate of somewhere between 50% and 80%. Okay, so we don't know how many of the people the Times listed actually had the disease or were really tested for it, or how many cases were autopsies performed to determine if that was the cause of death, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is just it's guesswork. It's extremely morbid, terroristic guesswork, you know, that's meant to have us bend over for ever longer lockdowns and, you know, hunger desperately for this vaccine that Bill Gates and Fauci are so heavily invested in. Plus, of course, here's a bit of a callback. How many of the people who died were put on ventilators? You know, that's another very important question that's never posed, it's never asked.
Right.
We should also ask, because some intelligent people have brought up a connection, how many of the people who died have had flu shots over the last year, you know? Because there was a new flu vaccine administered throughout northern Italy in late 2019, and they gave it to a lot of the old people there.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the name of the syndrome, but this is one of these vaccines that can actually heighten your susceptibility to a serious case of COVID-19. I mean, these are questions that if we had an honest press, they would be asking the questions that we're raising in our conversation here.
Yeah, there would be a debate, at least, amongst the epidemiologists who we've...
If you're at all curious,
you can go online and, you know, search for minority opinion COVID-19 or Journeyman Pictures, as you were saying, has an excellent series of epidemiologists questioning the current mindset about COVID-19.
Yeah, and it's an ever-growing list. I mean, there are a lot of... You know what it's like? It reminds me of the moment after 9/11 when security experts all over the world were pretty much unanimous in saying that the attacks on 9/11 should have been treated as a crime and not as an act of war. You know, that was a widespread consensus.
Mm-hmm.
It was never reported in the American press. You know, Americans hooked up to the New York Times or the network, CNN or whatever, had no clue that this decision to treat that as an act of war was actually bizarre, you know, because it wasn't a country that carried it out, right? Afghanistan didn't attack the United States.
Right.
So it's the same now. I mean, there are dozens of really highly reputable virologists, epidemiologists, immunologists, biowarfare specialists who have important things to say about the proper way to deal with this crisis, and we're not allowed to hear them. You know, that's conspiracy theory. And when, you know, occasionally one of them breaks through, like Judy Mikovits, you know, that mm-hmm. plandemic, you know, which may have its flaws, but it's a very powerful and largely compelling, piece of work based on her story. I mean, she has been, you know, mercilessly slandered. The piling on by the media is really amazing. If somebody manages to attract enough attention so that they can't be ignored, mm-hmm. they're then smeared. They're slandered.
Character assassination.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
That's how our free press operates.
Yeah, and I'm also was really disappointed in the, you know, so-called alternative press, because I expected at least they would be looking at, you know, maybe Democracy Now! Is fairly, you know, famous for having lengthy debates on some scientific issues, although they've fallen short, certainly in some departments. But I didn't hear anything from them. It was exactly like reading the New York Times. You know, it's like every scientist agrees with the data, you know, the interpretation of the data and the way forward, you know, the technique to fight this.
That's right. Yeah. Democracy Now.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it's absolutely right. I mean, Consortium News, you know, the great alternative outlet that was founded by Bob Perry, rest in peace, you know, the investigative reporter who broke the story of the October surprise by the Reagan team back in 1980,
mm-hmm.
you know, they made a deal with Iran to hang on to the hostages past Election Day. He had worked at AP and Newsweek and found that his reporting on that and aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal were being censored, so he quit and started his own outlet, Consortium News. He died a little over a year ago, an untimely death.
Hmm.
And now Consortium News, which had continued to be pretty strong after his passing, they did a special piece. The entire editorial board did a special piece highlighting an impassioned tirade by the head, somebody at the UN, deploring conspiracy theories about the COVID virus, you know.
Yeah.
Conspiracy theories, like, you know, raising questions about its origins, that kind of thing. And I wrote a piece in which I lamented this complete cave-in by what had been a pillar of the alternative press. You know, now reading, like, as you say, the editorial page in the New York Times. The same is the case with a lot of left voices and outlets. You know, we have a fake left in this country. It's not really a left. And it pains me to say this, but I have long since come to see Noam Chomsky as a good example of this. I mean, this is somebody whose work profoundly influenced me, which I long admired and read closely, until I came to notice that while he's always been very good on issues that matter only to the left, okay, on the Kennedy assassination, on the King assassination, mm-hmm. on 9/11, on election theft, Bush Cheney's election theft, on these really significant state crimes against democracy, on these issues, which could potentially stoke widespread rebellion if the truth about them were made known. On these issues, Chomsky has been just like the New York Times, and so has Amy Goodman been just like the New York Times, you know. So, you know, that tells us something. You know, I don't know in Chomsky's case what explains this weird orthodoxy of his. It could just be his, you know, excessive structuralism, you know, his view that there are no conspiracies, it's just the system functioning in a certain way. Mm-hmm. Some people think he's actually an asset. I don't know if I think that. He's extremely arrogant, so it's impossible to argue with him. I mean, I've tried myself. But, you know, that he's part of the problem. Democracy Now! Is part of the problem. Mother Jones is part of the problem. You know, the Nation is often part of the problem. They've done some good things. But we don't really have a left press, you know, that is willing to go against the grain. You know, the propaganda drive that created the meme of conspiracy theory, mm-hmm. starting in 1967, this is the CIA's first response to critics of the Warren Report. I'm always talking about this. I'll mention it again for those who haven't heard me. There's a memo 1035960. People can look it up online. They can also get an excellent book called Conspiracy Theory in America by Lance DeHaven Smith from the University of Texas Press, which is a full exposition of exactly how the CIA first introduced the notion of a conspiracy theorist as a pejorative label into the bloodstream of American journalism. This was early 1967. A memo sent to all their station chiefs worldwide urging them to get their propaganda assets and friends in the media to attack the writings of, this is people like Mark Lane, you know, and several others who had written very successful and trenchant critiques of the Warren Report, and we're getting some traction with the public.
Yeah.
The response of the CIA was to discredit them systematically, not only by referring to them as conspiracy theorists, but by making one of, I think there were five arguments or pseudo-arguments against their claims. And the one that's the most enduring that we continue to hear is that if there were a conspiracy of that magnitude, somebody would have talked by now, mm-hmm. and the press would have blown the whole thing wide open, right?
Right.
That's a fallacious argument. It is actually possible to keep conspiracies a secret for a long time. You know, if people are under military discipline and their work is compartmentalized. So, I mean, the Manhattan Project comes to mind. I think it involved about 100,000 people working on different aspects of it over years, and it never broke. Nobody ever spilled the beans, you know.
Right.
Moreover, in the case of the Kennedy assassination, several people did talk, you know, and they all ended up, you know, meeting untimely deaths of various kinds. They were neutralized, you know. So this is 67, and if you do searches on the phrase conspiracy theory in the archives of the Times and the Washington Post and Time magazine, you discover that the phrase, you know, had been used up to that point only now and then,
mm-hmm.
and in various ways, in various contexts, whereas starting in 1967, it's used more and more. And more over the ensuing decades, through the other assassinations, through 9/11, and so on.
Yeah.
And always in the same way, always to discredit people who are raising questions about possible state crimes against democracy, which is Lance DeHaven Smith's concept, state crimes against democracy. So, you know, it's used in a particular way, and it's used more and more, and it's been so successful that we have all internalized it, you know. We have all how well-founded or well-informed those suspicions may be, we often feel we have to say, well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but, I mean, that's something you hear people say all the time, you know? So you have to kind of learn to trust your suspicions once again, because it's not only natural, but healthy and necessary in a democracy for people to assume that elites are up to no good. You know, the very, very rich and powerful will act in their own best interest. They will try to take our rights away. They will try to put limits on our freedom. They will try to take our money. They'll try to take our Social Security because they are pathologically greedy and power mad. I mean, that's the nature of power. This is not an original insight of mine, you know?
Well, sure. It's kind of human nature. And, you know, and if it's not for nefarious purposes, it's, you know, called planning, basically. You get together and you plan, you know, for a goal that you all agree on.
Right. It's business as usual.
It's good business practices. It's just when it becomes something illegal or undemocratic in a democratic country that it becomes a conspiracy. It's always funny to me that it's so powerful, but I think it triggers a fear of ostracization, if I'm saying that right, from your fellow human beings, and it just really cuts to the core of all of us.
Well, that's absolutely true. Propaganda... it isn't just, you know, slanted facts, disinformation, fake news, whatever you want to call it. It isn't just that kind of dubious content that comprises propaganda, but it's also a way for you to establish your identity as a member of a certain collectivity, you know, as a member of the mass that you identify with. You know, so liberals are really dangerously susceptible to what we call the liberal media, just as a lot of people on the right are susceptible to the Murdoch Empire's propaganda. But both sides, liberal and conservative, do tend to fling that phrase around, conspiracy theory.
Yeah, they do.
And you know, I mean, lately I've noted with some astonishment that the best reporting and commentary on this crisis is coming from the right. You know, it's coming from Tucker Carlson, who has emerged as the most eloquent defender of constitutional freedoms out there now that the ACLU is morphed into a social justice advocacy organization, you know. Laura Ingraham, you know, whom I was always critical of, has interviewed some of these epidemiologists you and I are talking about, and they're excellent interviews. And the subjects she's interviewing are not right-wingers. They're just doctors and scientists. And it's the New York Post that breaks a lot of stories that the rest of the press ignores, you know. I guess you could say that in this situation, you know, where we're faced with the specter of medical fascism on a global scale, people on the right have the advantage of distrusting big government, which is starting to look like a wise attitude.
Now, do you think that's where... go ahead. Sorry, Mark.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, do you think that's why the right distrusts... they seem to distrust medicine in general more, or at least they're skeptical about it, where the left seems to accept, you know, anything a doctor says.
Well, I would say that, I mean, there is a significant sector of the left that's into organic food and natural cures and stuff like that. I mean, that's, in a way, kind of beyond politics, but...
Yeah.
I've not, you know, black people are completely rightly... very distrustful of the medical establishment because the horrific history of their abuse and exploitation for experimental purposes, you know. What we really need is for people on the left to wake up. What we need is for woke people to wake up for real to the profound dangers of a medical system that is completely profit-driven and controlled by Big Pharma, and Bill Gates's vast fortune, you know. Oh, by the way, I want to be sure to mention, if your listeners haven't heard about it, to plug James Corbett's series of four shows on Bill Gates, the latest of which, the fourth of which, and the culmination of which is called Who is Bill Gates? This is really must-watch video. It's a 30-minute analysis of Gates's background in eugenics and his family's commitment to eugenics and their collaboration with the Rockefellers on eugenics. The Rockefellers were long heavily involved in the eugenics movement in this country from around the turn of the last century up to the Third Reich, right? When Hitler applied what he had been learning from American eugenicists with catastrophic consequences, right? And the Holocaust comes directly out of that.
Yeah.
That put eugenics under a cloud. It now was no longer permissible in polite society to talk about eugenics. So what the movement did was rebrand itself as a movement for population control, okay? That became a very big thing starting after World War II, and it kind of peaked in the 70s with the population bomb by Dr. Paul Ehrlich. Became a huge issue, and it has kind of contaminated and hijacked the green movement, you know, because you got a lot of people now in the climate change movement who literally and explicitly see humanity itself as the problem, you know.
Yeah.
It's not the elites, you know, whose carbon footprint is exponentially larger than any of ours. It's not the military, which is the biggest polluter on the planet. It's humankind, you know. We are a vast pollutant, you know, and we have to be whittled down to size. And Gates used to be very explicit about this, and still is, when he talks about the necessity of reducing population 10 to 15% through the use of vaccines. Now, his line on this sounds kind of benevolent because he says if people in poor countries can lower the infant mortality rate, they'll stop having so many children. And vaccines are the way to lower that mortality rate. Well, that sounds fine,
kind of.
Except for the fact that, you know, vaccines that have been provided to the Third World under his aegis or by the World Health Organization not long after he became its largest single funder turned out to have the effect of sterilizing people. This happened in Kenya with a tetanus vaccine that was laced with HCG and was causing spontaneous miscarriages. James Corbett goes into all this, and it is very sobering and important. You know, it's not something that a traditional left analysis takes into account, the eugenic dimension of these efforts, you know, to lower the world's population, to lower the birth rate, to solve the elite's key problem, which is the specter of mass resistance, by making the mass smaller and more controllable, you know. And it's Gates who is funding the, you know, nanotechnology that would be used in vaccinations to literally track every single human being on the planet. I mean, it's right out of Philip K. Dick, you know. It's pure dystopia. But it's not conspiracy theory. This is all fact. This is empirically demonstrable, you know.
It's what they're working on. Yeah.
It's what they're explicitly working on. People who write this off as conspiracy theory just can't handle it. It's not that they can prove that there's nothing to it. It's that they don't want to face it. You know, I have defined conspiracy theory as something that, if true, you couldn't handle it. You know,
yeah.
That's what conspiracy theory really means.
Yeah, that's a good definition of it, I think. And talk a little bit, if you can, about Gates's influence on the media. He seems to be able to not only have his hands in the development of these dystopian products, but he's also doing the marketing through the mainstream and the non-commercial medias that we all depend on.
Yeah. His foundation is a kind of inexhaustible fount of largesse for media organizations, both directly and indirectly. Big Pharma is, an enormously powerful advertiser across the board. Dell Bigtree on The High Wire, which is another show that I strongly recommend. It's on every week. It's like a two-hour show. He has said, I think I've got him right here, that Big Pharma accounts for something like half of the advertising revenues of many of these major outlets. When you pick up the New York Times, you know, which is like pamphlet thin these days compared to the old days, you know.
Is it? Oh yeah.
You'll often find a whole page of advertising for some drug from GlaxoSmithKline or Merck or Pfizer. That's not because they want the readers of the paper to learn about that drug. That's a bribe, you know. That's a payoff, you know. I mean, this has been a problem in commercial media since the middle of the 19th century, you know, that once the press in this country ceased to be circulation-driven and became increasingly advertising-driven because the cost of production kept going up, you know, as the technology of printing newspapers became more elaborate and expensive, the media inevitably started to favor its advertisers over its readers. This is ancient history. This has been going on forever. This is something that Upton Sinclair exposed in his book The Brass Check in, I think, 1917, something like that. And this is just a fundamental fact about commercial media. You know, its owners and its advertisers call the tune, you know, and they respond to this. So it's not surprising that Bill Gates is treated as a sage and a saint across the board. I mean, it's also been facilitated by Inside Bill's Brain, you know, this propaganda documentary supposedly about him. I mean, if you know anything at all about the man Bill Gates, you know, if you're not suffering from amnesia and you've done a little reading or have a memory of, you know, over 20 years ago, he's an extremely driven and rapacious monopolist, you know. I mean, he derived his fortune from monopoly practices that resulted in a big federal suit against him, you know, an antitrust suit that they eventually settled. Well, a year later, he started the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and this was a means both profiting him further by giving him a sort of tax-exempt way to invest in various highly profitable businesses, okay, which he does. And I should add that since he formed his foundation 20 years ago, his wealth has doubled. You know, it's gone from about $50 billion to $100 billion as he has invested in, you know, vaccines, as he has invested in remote learning. He's invested in GMO crops. He's invested in nuclear power. He's invested in just about lab-grown meat. I mean, he's invested in geoengineering. I mean, all the worst things in the world.
Yeah,
you know?
All the
poisonous
technologies.
He's invested heavily in all of them. Right,
yeah,
right,
right.
So the foundation is a way for him to profit himself, but it is also a way for him to brand himself as a kind of Father Teresa, you know, as a saintly figure. Suddenly, this domineering, contemptuous, close-minded, and incredibly greedy monopolist, who is really a lot like John D. Rockefeller, you know, in terms of his character and morality, you know, as well as his business practices, suddenly he's treated as this oracle, you know. know, this wonderful saintly figure who's trying to help the people of the world. This is ludicrous. You know, this is one of the biggest snow jobs in history. But it works, you know. Propaganda works. So we don't hear anything now about his close relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, you know, his many meetings with Jeffrey Epstein, who was also a eugenicist. This comes up in James Corbett's documentary, that, you know, Epstein had this crackpot vision of turning his compound with all those young girls in it into a baby farm. He wanted to impregnate 20 women at a time. I'm not making this up. This sounds like a joke. But he was nuts, you know. He was crazy.
Yeah.
And he wanted to improve the human race by, you know, replicating himself genetically throughout it. Well, that's probably the basis of his and Gates's relationship. And, you know, they were talking about, you know, pretty... considerable financial partnership, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of connections between the Gates apparatus and Epstein's operation. This was broken by the New York Times like 7 months ago, and even MSNBC kind of picked up with it and ran with it, but it had no traction. It's been dropped, you know. It's
yeah.
been dropped.
And you wonder why.
So Roman Polanski's new film, An Officer and a Spy, about the Dreyfus Affair, which happens to be a brilliant film, can't even get released in the United States because of his, you know, awful history back in the 70s of, you know, sexual predation.
Yeah.
So we can't even see his movie. But Bill Gates can pal around with Jeffrey Epstein and do business with him after his sex crimes were public knowledge, and he gets a pass, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's because he's a sainted figure. It's really very dangerous because he is not someone who should be in charge of making decisions about the health of the human race. You know, with this.
Right, he's a self-appointed planner of our future genetics, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And it's not just that his propaganda has been so effective. He funds a lot of the health news coverage of the BBC, and I think
right.
at PBS and NPR.
That's right, and you know, NBC, I think.
And so if he's funding that coverage for the same issues that his products are supposedly solving, that really does seem like a conflict of interest.
A major conflict of interest, absolutely.
And it's hard to believe that those networks can actually tolerate that conflict of interest, but they do express that, you know, he's a funder.
Yeah, they do. They boast of it, you know. I mean, the two outlets that came up with the wildly exaggerated predictions of more global mortality due to COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
That's Imperial College Oxford. London, and this outlet at the University of Washington. Those are the two sources of the models on which the whole lockdown policy has been based worldwide.
That's right.
Both of them funded by Bill Gates, both of them. So his money actually is the kind of engine that has driven the lockdown policy, which is vastly more lethal, is killing far many more people than COVID-19 could kill, you know, through despair, through, you know, mental illness, through medical neglect, you know, as people with strokes and heart attacks and cancer and so on are no longer getting timely treatment or any treatment. Suicide rates have spiked, you know, which gets covered here and there in a kind of a whisper. The lockdowns are destructive, they're catastrophic, and yet we have countless earnest liberals and progressives who become enraged if you question any aspect of the lockdown. You're accused of valuing dollars over human lives, you know. If you point out some of the science about how unhealthy it is for healthy people to walk around wearing masks, you're again accused of attempted genocide. You know, a study was just published, I think yesterday, online, by a team of Chinese researchers, which found that 455 contacts of people infected with COVID-19 were asymptomatic. These are asymptomatic cases of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. 459 contacts of those people showed no signs of infection after 5 days. The median time of incubation is 4 to 5 days. So there would have to be a follow-up to see if anybody, you know, might have gotten sick beyond 5 days. But this preliminary research suggests that asymptomatic carriers aren't contagious. They're not like Typhoid Mary, in other words. So that healthy people don't have to walk around wearing masks, you know, based on the fear that they might be asymptomatic carriers. If you wear masks wherever you go, you know, aside from the social and psychological effects, which are destructive,
yeah,
you're breathing in your own viruses instead of naturally exhaling them, mm-hmm, and you're depriving your blood of oxygen, and that's hypoxia, which we talked about before.
Yeah,
and there's a condition that's called, I think, hypocapnia, which is excessive CO2 in your blood. That also is brought on by wearing masks all over the place, so that you're lowering your immunity, right? So everybody's, you know, paranoid about a second wave. Well, that could happen, you know, especially if it's been weaponized, it could happen. And people who have compromised their immune systems by walking around wearing masks are going to be more vulnerable to that that revisitation, you know. But
yeah,
you can't talk about this. People just get pissed off because they're scared, you know.
That's right.
You're scared, you're not thinking.
Yeah, we have you know, articles in the paper up here, you know, scolding people and basically berating them for not, you know, wearing masks. And I can understand that, but you know, I wear a mask when I go in the store here just because everybody's so worried.
Right.
They're already traumatized by the news, you know, by the
news.
Yeah,
that's right.
They're hearing every day.
Well, I do. I mean, I'm 70, and I have Lyme disease, so I'm very careful.
Yeah.
And everybody in New York is masked in stores, but most people are also masked out on the street. And that's just a really bad idea, you know. And these poor guys who have to do all the delivering, you know,
mm-hmm,
now that everything comes from Amazon or takeout food, these are poor people, you know, on bikes and so on. And
sure,
they're all masked all over the place, and that's not good for them, you know.
Yeah, that is brutal.
Yeah.
So what else did I want to ask you? What about, do you want to talk about politics for a minute?
Sure.
We have elections coming up in November. And I was just, I think most of the people up here, I'm from Vermont, and most of the people here, many of them supported Bernie. And I think we were all very disappointed when what looked like a rapid rise to the nomination was just, you know, delivered a swift and deadly blow. And he went down and immediately started, you know, cooperating with Biden. And I was just wondering what your take is on Bernie and the whole election phenomena in this country.
Well, I was a big Bernie supporter, you know. I think Bernie was the people's choice in 2016. And I think it was 11 primaries were stolen from him. And that Hillary was the beneficiary of those thefts. 2016 was the year that election theft, finally brought forth its most poisonous fruit, because you had Hillary running against Trump when it should have been Bernie running against Trump, because Bernie would have beat Trump, I think, walking away.
I think so.
And Trump didn't actually win in 2016. At least, let me simply say that there is copious forensic evidence that the three swing states that he seemingly won were actually stolen. his own team didn't expect him to win. Their own polling foretold a defeat. That's why he went to bed early on election night. And I found out from that guy Anthony Scaramucci that they didn't even have an acceptance speech drafted. Okay, they had no expectation he was going to win.
Wow.
I think it came as a huge surprise to him and Melania, who looked horrified. I mean, it was right on camera. But he wanted to go home and start planning his own TV network, I think, is what he wanted to do. But
yeah.
he was chosen by whoever makes these choices. Then Bernie runs again, right, as you've said. And to me, it's abundantly obvious that he was robbed again. You know, he was screwed out of the Iowa caucuses. I didn't really think he could steal a caucus, but they managed to come up with a phone app.
That's
that
right.
Took care, right? I mean, which completely unnecessary, but it threw the outcome into doubt and enabled the myth that Buttigieg had beaten Bernie.
Yeah.
Now the kicker for me was Bernie's losing the Massachusetts primary. That was the thing that really floored me, that Biden won the Massachusetts primary. Now, just a few days before that primary, there was a poll by one of the TV stations in Boston which showed Bernie in the lead with, I think it was 25% of the vote. Warren was, and it's her state, remember,
yeah.
Massachusetts. Warren was second with, I think, 17%. I mean, these numbers, that people should check them. Biden came in fifth in that poll. He had 9%. Okay.
Yeah.
And then he wins the primary? Are you kidding me? I mean, who could possibly believe this, right? So what does Bernie do? And this is the guy I supported, remember?
Yeah.
Bernie folds, as you say. Bernie just completely caves. Bernie doesn't raise any questions about the vote. He had never taken any precautions against a repeat of what happened in 2016. You know, the theft of those primaries was documented chapter and verse in this 109-page report called Democracy Lost from an outfit called Election Justice USA. There's no doubt about it. It's completely obvious that it was stolen. By whom, we don't exactly know. We know that the vote suppression was carried out by the Democratic National Committee, but the electronic fraud was probably the work of Republican operatives, because that's their specialty. And they didn't want Trump running against Bernie, right? They wanted Trump running against Hillary.
Yeah.
So what does Bernie do this time? Nothing. He does nothing. He waltzes into the primary process as if what happened 4 years before hadn't happened. And this is when I started to wonder about him, to distrust him. Now, Jill Stein, bless her heart, after the 2016 election, forthrightly and properly raised funds to do, you know, forensic investigation of the vote counts in the three swing states that Trump won. And she found a lot of, you know, further evidence that he didn't really win them. You may remember she was excoriated for this.
Oh, yeah. She was a Russian operative,
because there was a picture of her sitting at a table, the same big table as Putin at some event. This was just, I mean, I spoke to her. I mean, she had to get herself a police dog, you know.
Gee.
I mean, she was like public enemy number one. Oh. Well, Bernie wasn't going to do that, you know. Bernie has never taken that risk, you know. He's never put himself out to preserve the democratic process. So, you know, as soon as he immediately folded and vowed his allegiance to Joe Biden, who, for my money, is kind of hard to differentiate from Trump, you know, except he's a bigger phony. Trump is at least an overt, straightforward ape. You know, Trump doesn't do lip service. Trump is the face of U.S. power without the mask on. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Biden will, you know, make these meachy and unconvincing semi-progressive noises and talk about people at the kitchen table and all that crap, you know. this guy is completely corrupt. He would cut Social Security. He would bend over for the Pentagon, you know.
Yeah.
He would vigorously destabilize foreign governments. He is an obvious racist, you know. He is also a sex offender, you know. I happen to believe Tara Reid, you know, is another much maligned figure. Here he is running, and Bernie is backing him, and even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is backing him, but she's another phony, too. You know, she stands with the junta in Bolivia, right? She attacks Maduro's government in Venezuela. She's another one of these fake progressives, you know, like Ilhan Omar, our first Somali-American congressperson, who has recently hailed the Pentagon for striving for greater transparency and accountability in its drone bombing of her native country. Okay?
Wow.
These are our progressives, the squad. These are our progressives. I mean, this is breathtaking to me. But it just goes to show that we don't really have a left in this country anymore. You know, it's all about social justice posturing, pronoun policing, taking down statues of Confederate war figures. You know, that's all symbolism. That's all theater. You know,
but
that's
not.
Well, they're not going after the elites. You know, they're all kind of funded by the elites themselves. So it's all part of the pro wrestling match that we were talking about before. You know, the squad are that side of the wrestling match that we cheer on, you know, and Trump is the side we boo, you know. It's ridiculous.
And somebody pointed out recently, and maybe you know who this is, but they were saying that the left appears not to be interested in actual power, like you say.
Yeah, that's right. That was Matt Stoller in that great interview that Journeyman Pictures did.
Yeah, that was very insightful.
Yeah, it was a great interview because here's a guy who was, you know, a big D Democrat, very proud and dedicated, and has come to see that it's a charade. And as you note, he makes this point that the left isn't interested in power. You know, they're not interested in elite power. He says they do art criticism.
Yeah.
I thought it was a great line. You know, it's true. They do art criticism. They focus on what people say and their gaffes, you know, and whether they have the right assortment of persons of color in their immediate orbit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who will be overjoyed if Stacey Abrams or Kamala Harris becomes Joe Biden's running mate, you know, as if that will make any difference whatsoever, you know.
It's
really amazing.
Yeah. So, Mark, just to finish up here, what would you recommend if people want to broaden their horizons a little bit past the mainstream media? What would you recommend people go to and avail themselves of?
Well, we've mentioned the Perspectives on the Pandemic series. I've mentioned The High Wire with Del Bigtree. He focuses mainly on vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I invite people to join my listserv. They email me, markcrispinmiller@gmail, and just send me their email addresses. I'll sign them up. You know, I send out a lot of stuff every day from different sources worldwide and occasionally write my own piece. There really are a lot of great outlets out there, but, you know, they're getting harder and harder to find. If you try to look for them via Google, you can't find them. You know, this will happen with Black Agenda Report, for example, which is a great publication. Caitlin Johnston writes practically a daily commentary that's always very good. But Google, you know, will de-rank anything that's threatening to the official narrative, so you can't find stuff that way.
That's
You've got
right.
to try using Start Page or DuckDuckGo, which are less heavily policed than the others. But, I mean, what this really tells us is, I mean, the key issue here is that the Internet should not be dominated by private corporations. You know, we've just accepted this. We've accepted the fact that our commons, Facebook, Google, you know, YouTube, Twitter, we just accepted fact that they're privately owned and worth billions of dollars. We need something on the order of the post office as it was originally conceived. It should be publicly funded and completely neutral and unpoliced, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, now liberals and progressives believe in censorship. They believe in censoring hate speech and disinformation, whatever else they want to call it. If something makes them uncomfortable, it should be censored. That's not an acceptable position, you know, for anyone who believes in constitutional freedoms and real democracy. Because the category of hate speech becomes so flexible that it prohibits any detached scientific discussion, for example, of transgender ideology, you know, of radical medical intervention in the sexual development of children. I mean, that kind of practice should be open to civil scientific exchanges, right? You can't do that. Those doctors who've tried to raise questions about the destructiveness and dangers of that kind of intervention are condemned as purveyors of hate speech. They're accused of transphobia. Well, you know, then you can't have a discussion. And an extremely lucrative and catastrophically destructive kind of medical practice just continues unabated and is ruining people's lives, you know. So, you know, ultimately this is all about public control of the media. We get there, I don't know. But at the moment, we're all, I think, rightly focused on how to get through this crisis without ending up microchips and shot full of toxins, you know, having our every transaction
monitored,
you know, in a cashless society.
Yeah,
all that stuff is really frightening, and people are obligated to familiarize themselves with the information about it. James Corbett, I mentioned him earlier, is another excellent source.
Are you familiar with Whitney Webb?
Yeah, Whitney Webb's stuff is great. The Last American Vagabond is her website. She was at Mint Press News, which I continue to recommend. I'm good friends with its editor, Manar Muahesh, in Minnesota. That's a great outlet. Whitney has spun off into her own thing. Also, on the green agenda, there's a very, very gifted investigative reporter named Corey Morningstar, who's up in Canada, and she has done probably the best work on the whole Greta Thunberg Extinction Rebellion net zero thing, which is actually closely tied with what's happening now.
Oh.
And is also, Corbett has talked about this too, there's a kind of depopulation dimension to this thing, and it's all about corporate control. You know, it looks like a spontaneous grassroots thing, but it really isn't. And I have to say, Michael Moore, whom I've criticized often in the past, I think that for the most part, his documentary, the new one, what's it called again?
I haven't seen it. I've only heard about it.
I'm completely blanking on the name of it. It's come under withering attack by people in the climate movement. But it is very good on exposing the corporate backing for a lot of that movement. You know, it's some of the biggest polluters on the planet are actually supporting the climate movement as symbolized by Greta Thunberg. And Corey Morningstar really gets into the nitty-gritty of identifying the nonprofits that are used to sort of half-conceal the corporate actors behind all this. You know, they want to monetize and control the natural world. It's actually an attempt to reboot capitalism and tighten its grip on nature. It's not in any sense a radical movement. It's radical in the wrong direction, you know.
Yeah.
And it part of its thing is a cashless society, and you know, kind of austerity measures to dial down development, even in countries where they actually need development. You know, poor countries in Africa are entitled to have electricity, for example. You know, but there's something about the climate movement as it has evolved that's really quite sinister and not what it appears to be. And the Michael Moore, Planet of the Humans, that's the name of it. Planet of the Humans. Yeah,
okay.
It's worth watching. It's got some flaws, but it's really very good.
Yeah, okay.
I think
I'll check it out. And Whitney Webb was talking about the planning behind crises like this COVID thing is to bring our society closer to China's, more surveillance.
That's right.
You know, eliminate all the legacy activities we have, like you were saying, cash and visiting doctors in person and all the
driving
things.
Driving
your own car, right. All the stuff that kind of you think of as being, you know, free and human.
She's absolutely right about that. You know, the U.S. has been slouching towards Beijing for a while. I mean, on the one hand, there's a kind of war going on, or at least what looks like a war. It could be more pro wrestling. On the other hand, we are emulating China, you know.
Yeah.
But incrementally, by increments, by little covert steps, through algorithms, you know, we're inching in the same direction. We're inching toward the place where China is today. China can just do what it wants to do, and everybody can see it, right? China's control of the internet is manifest. It's explicit. People recognize it. They know it. They make no bones about it.
Yeah.
Over here, they have to kind of tiptoe in that direction because we have a First Amendment, and we like to think we have the right to privacy and so on.
Yeah.
But they're galloping in that direction and moving towards a social credit system. And it really is like Black Mirror, increasingly, like that show, Black Mirror, you know. So there's an ostensible war between the U.S. and China, but the U.S. is emulating China. And this is a point that Tucker Carlson made, you know, which in a very astute commentary of his. It's true. It's absolutely true.
Yeah, that's a little scary.
It's very scary. But I want to leave your audience not terrified, but indignant and resolved to act, because you know, if people do act as they inevitably will, even if it's only 15% of us, things can change for the better. This is not a foregone conclusion. You know, the plan that Gates and his peers have hatched is a crackpot plan. It depends on near universal acquiescence, right?
Yeah.
But just as there are some police, some policemen who have refused to police social distancing, have spoken out against it, there are members of the military who won't go along with this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The country is more divided than we think, right? And it should be divided, and those who protest should be respected for protesting and not attacked as brown shirts, you know.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the people who've turned out in state capitals like Sacramento and Austin, I've seen the videos of these gatherings. These are not right-wing gatherings, you know. These are not Trumpist gatherings. They are diverse. There are Christians there, you know. There are hippies. There are anarchists. There are just regular people who believe in the Constitution. You know, there are people who have good reason to distrust the vaccine regimen of the CDC. There are people who have good reason to distrust 5G, you know. Mm-hmm. These are things that we can stop. Other parts of the world have stopped these things, and we can too. So it's very important to make contact with others who have their eyes wide open as opposed to wide shut, you know, and share information. And take whatever steps we can take to halt this movement into dystopia.
All right. Well, Mark, on that note, I think we can conclude the show. And thanks so much for being on.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Good to talk to you, Mark.
Same here.
Okay.
Bye-bye.